Hello, everybody, and welcome into another edition of the Best in True Crime Radio. This is a True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennison for Dave Schrader. A lot of you might have been tuned into social media the last couple of days and noticed that Dave's daughter, Ripley, has had some complications with diabetes. She's in the hospital right now, and Dave didn't quite make it to air this afternoon to record True Crime Tuesday, obviously. So our thoughts and prayers are with Ripley, with Dave, and with the rest of the Schrader family. She is expected, at least as of airtime, to be released from the hospital sometime today, but it didn't happen as of airtime this afternoon. So we'll continue to send our thoughts and prayers along to Ripley and hope that she is out sometime soon here today, or if not today, then tomorrow, and hope that we just continue along with what's going on with Ripley, and that she continues to get healthier and stronger as the days continue here. So we love you, Rip, and just continue to keep getting better. We also want to remind you that we have a little promotion going on here on True Crime Tuesday. That if you're new to True Crime Tuesday, thank you for signing up on Patreon. And I want to remind you that we have this new promotion going on Patreon, where we're going to be giving away $500 by the end of the year, beginning of next year. And contrary to what Dave says, it's not all coming out of my pocket. So don't believe that for a minute, but it's coming out of his. So here's the deal. Stay signed up for True Crime Tuesday. Everybody's hat, everyone who's a member of True Crime Tuesday gets thrown into the hat for that $500. So keep subscribed to True Crime Tuesday, the best in true crime radio. Every single Tuesday, your name stays in there. And by the end of the year, we'll draw for that $500 cash prize. So there you go. You could win $500 for being a patron of True Crime Tuesday. And that'll happen here by the end of the year. And we'll give you more details as the days go by here on True Crime Tuesday. Make sure you stay tuned to our social media. You can catch us on Twitter. It's at True Crime 2, T-U-E, at True Crime 2 on Twitter. And also on our social media pages at Beyond Dark Show on Twitter, and also on Facebook and on Instagram. You can find us all at darknessradio.com. All the pages are there for our social media, and all the details are there for the Patreon giveaway. So make sure that you go there and catch up with us on social media. Also, darknessevents.com is the page to go to see where you can catch Dave and I around the nation. We've got Michigan Paracon coming up in August, so that's the next stop. So darknessevents.com is where you can catch us around the nation. And we want to know, too, would you be interested in a true crime convention? A true crime convention in your neck of the woods, or even up here in beautiful Minneapolis, maybe sometime in the fall. Let us know. Would you want to come out and talk to some of our true crime authors that we have on the show? Maybe some true crime guests, some of the folks that we've had here on the show. Would you like to come out and meet some of them and talk to some of them and maybe get together and listen to some panels by them? So let us know. Would you want to be part of a true crime convention? So hit us up, Dave at darknessradio.com, Tim at darknessradio.com. We want your feedback on that as well. Let's get into today's show, shall we? No dumb crime, stupid criminals at the tail end of today's show. We'll save that for next week. It'll be a little bit of a shortened version of today's show, but a good show nonetheless. We've got Chris Russo Blackwood with us today. Chris is a first-time author, but a longtime journalist, and she brings to us today a very interesting story. The name of the book is My Brother's Keeper, A 30-Year Quest to Bring Two Killers to Justice. It's out right now, and it's available on Amazon, and it's a tremendous story of love and murder and faith and tenacity, according to Steve Jackson of the New York Times. And this is a fascinating story, and this is a story that basically tells you that you should not give up. If you're a victim of a loved one being tragically murdered, you should never, ever, ever give up when it comes to finding a murderer. Let's bring in now Chris Russo Blackwood to True Crime Tuesday. Good afternoon, Chris. How are you?
Good afternoon. I'm doing great. A couple of things before I dive into the book. I certainly want to wish Dave and his family the best. And also, I would love to attend a true crime convention in Minneapolis. I think it'd be awesome.
I think
it would be a lot of fun.
It's something we've kicked around for a while, and we kind of want to gauge that interest, and it'd be something that we'd love to do. I think we've heard of them, we've seen them go on around the country, and there's really been this groundswell for true crime in the last few years, and especially in our genre of true crime podcast, true crime radio. And it's about time to get something major going, true crime conventions, I think,
around the nation. I'll certainly stay tuned to see where y'all, that goes, because I'd love to be a part of it.
Most definitely.
But,
we'd love to bring you in.
As far as my brother's keeper, mm-hmm. You are so right about never giving up about a loved one who's been murdered or disappeared. The brother in my story, Ted Kurgan, was dogged, determined that he would not lose track of the two individuals that he knew killed his brother. And lengths that he went to, the money that he spent, the time that he spent, private investigators all over the country, it's a remarkable story. You think that it also kind of makes you think about your own family and what you would do, and it's kind of like, how far would I go? And I've used that a lot in trying to talk about the book with others. It's like, really, you think you would do that, but even if you had the resources, I think there are very few people who would go to the extent that Ted Kurgan went to bring these individuals to justice.
Well, let's start off.
So it's a great story.
And we'll get to that story here in a bit, Chris. Let's start out with you first. And I'd mentioned previously that you're a journalist, and a journalist of 40 years. Is that correct? Is that what?
Yes. I started my career. I'm a native of Baton Rouge. I started my career in Baton Rouge at the Daily newspaper here, The Advocate. But I've been a feature writer all my life, doing stories about people, kind of led me down this path to the book. But how I got into the book is a whole other story that I'll be glad to tell you, too. But yes, I worked at the Daily newspaper here as a feature section editor. And then I started my own magazine, a city magazine, in 1989, and I had that for 20 years before I sold it in 2009. And I got involved in this book in 2012. And I kind of got, the way I got involved was through a friend of mine who worked for Ted Kurgan, the murder victim's brother, as a public relations person. Ted and his brother Gary, the deceased, own a chain of Sonic restaurants in Louisiana. So she had done work for them. And we happened to be having lunch when she found out that the murder victims had been rearrested for a crime that took place 28 years before. They had just arrested them in New York. And so, she was all excited, and she couldn't tell me a whole lot. There were a lot of things that were confidential at that point, but she was a confidant of Ted Kurgan, so she was on the ground floor of the investigation, and so she was giving me bits and pieces, and I was totally enthralled, and I was, from that moment on, I was pulled in. It was a five-year crazy journey, but I loved every minute of it.
Now, up until this point, now you had mentioned you were a feature editor, and then you'd had the magazine. Was true crime something that was kind of in your... I'll put it this way. Was it in your holster? Was it in your chamber? Was it something that was in your ensemble for interest? Was it something that kind of came across your desk and you said, ooh, that's something I'd really like to get a hold of? Because as a feature editor and even in your magazine, you run across a wide variety of different stories. And obviously those stories are wide in variety and wide in scope. And you're trying to find a hook to make the story interesting to a wide variety of readers. Whereas true crime is kind of narrow. True crime has a narrow scope. So is true crime something that really is something that kind of turns your gears? Or was this something where, hey, I have a connection. I see the value in the story, and I'm going after this. What was it that turned you on about the story?
I think it's the latter. I think I saw the value in the story. The story has incredible twists and turns. There's a lot of coincidences that take place. And even while I was embedded in this investigation with everyone else that Ted Kurgan had working as a unit alongside parallel to police investigation, so to speak. I mean, there were plenty of times when you know, I thought this needs to be a book. But then there were plenty of times when a lot of things would need to fall into place for there actually to be a story. You know, one of the murderers was in poor health. You know, there were a lot of times when the whole story could have fallen apart, but it didn't. And so, you know, I just stuck it out. And, you know, I was just, like I said, I was just really taken in by the story. So yes, I've done feature stories. I've done some about murder victims, you know, the people who survived, a murder of a loved one, but nothing in depth like this. The story grabbed hold of me and it wouldn't let go. So, I mean, I was pretty much preoccupied with it from the time I heard about it.
Obviously, you've got the difference between writing for a newspaper, writing for a magazine, writing for a novel or a book, and getting fleshing out a longer form story. But what's other than the obvious differences, what was the difference for you for sitting down and fleshing out this story? Give me an emotional difference for you.
Oh, an emotional difference. Well, I guess that you have to really put yourself inside each character's shoes. You have to. One thing I learned about myself that because I'm really pretty much a social person by nature, but I learned to sit in a room by myself without any stimulus for 8-10 hours a day, and to sit there and really think. I mean, I had reams. I was very lucky. I had reams and reams of information to work from. You know, PI interviews. I had, you know, court documents. I had one of the murderer's diaries, had a lot of things, but I actually had to sit there and put myself in each character's shoes and try to think like them. I had conducted a ton of interviews. I got to talk to one of the murderers after the trial. I spent many hours with Ted Kirkin, many hours with his business partner, but I think the emotion of it was just to let it all sink in and to really try to feel it yourself, where each character was coming from. And that took, you know, you have to really drill down to do that, to let go of everything else and really try to feel it yourself.
And that's got to be a lot different, obviously, than journalism or newspaper reporting, where you're coming from an objective source, correct?
It is. It is. And, you know, dialogue is another thing that, you know, of course, I'm used to taking notes and to quoting people. So, you know, my accuracy in that, I felt really good about it. And it's a true story, so I felt really good about all my facts have been checked and everything. But you're right, the emotional quotient to make people feel it. And that's, to me, the biggest compliment when people say they couldn't put it down and you know, they really, you know, felt certain ways about each character. And you're right, that's the hardest thing to do. It takes a long time. It takes a long time to assimilate all the information, one, but then to draw the emotion out as well. And there were a lot of emotional moments in the story, though, that, you know, were really, really obvious. And I didn't really need to do a whole lot to those.
When you write stories, no matter what the emotional weight of those stories are for newspaper, you take them, you put them to bed, you're done with that, you move on to the next assignment. With this, you're living with it day to day. And how did you, as you're going through this, as you're writing, how did you put it down for the night, or how did you put it to bed so that you could pick it back up the next day and then move forward?
Well, you really can't. I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's the big difference. With a story, you're on a deadline, whether it's for a monthly or a daily or whatever, you're on a deadline, you wrap it up and you don't look back. You don't look back. But with this story, you know, it was a constant reevaluation of where it was, where it was going, the possible outcomes. You know, looking back, Ted was instrumental in compiling timelines, because although he had kept track of these people during the ensuing 28 years between the murder and their rearrest, there were a lot of things that he didn't know about them that he would uncover through private investigators. But, you know, there were timelines that had to be constructed for both of these murderers, and there was a plethora of characters that came forth. And so really, it was hard to sleep at night because, you know, you were anxious to see what, and especially after they were, you know, they were rearrested and would go through a number of different things. You know, there was every day, it seemed like, although it really could have been every day, but at least weekly, there was a major turn of events, the story turning in another direction.
Did this...
No, I didn't sleep very well that whole time.
Obviously. Now, obviously, as a person in media, and me being a person in media too, media affects our family, media affects a lot of our lives. You end up missing a lot of holidays and special occasions and whatnot. Did this book get in the way, much like I'm sure newspaper magazines and whatnot got in the way of family life? Did this book get in the way of family life as well? Did you get that consumed in the book that in the way?
It definitely did. It definitely did. I think it's Gillian Flynn who wrote Gone Girl. I think she said, you know, I did my best job because I felt like I spent all this time down in my basement writing a book away from my family, and you know, I needed to do the best job because I lost all that time. And I felt that when I read those words from her, I felt the exact same way. You do sacrifice a lot of family time because, you know, you are missing things. Like I said, I would lock myself up in a room and, you know, away from anybody because, you know, you really have to, at least I had to do that in order to put everything together. So yes, you definitely do. You miss out on a lot. So when you pour your heart and soul into something like this, I think, I'm sure most authors would tell you the whole thing, that they're missing they're so focused, but they're missing everything that's going on the sidelines of their life.
So now let's get to the actual story of how this ended up in your lap. You're at the magazine or was it at the point where you'd wrapped up the magazine that you've come across this story? How exactly did you come across this story again?
Well, it was as I'll keep telling you, I was having lunch with this friend of mine, and she was actually texting back and forth when the murderess, it was a couple who murdered Gary Kurgan, the victim, and the girl at the time in 1984 when the murder occurred, she was a 19-year-old former honor student, and she had hooked up with a 36-year-old costume clown who worked in a porno shop in New Orleans. So these were the murderers in 1984. After what happened in 1985, they went on and lived separate lives until 2012, when they were both rearrested. Some evidence came up, and it's a very coincidental thing. The Baton Rouge Police Department got its first ever federal funds for a cold case division, which they opened, and so they started looking through cases. And this case was called Sonic Gary because Gary and his brother owned Sonic restaurants, and there was DNA evidence. And in 1984, of course, there was not DNA testing. So they were able to match DNA to a relative of the victim, and that's why they decided to reopen this case. So the murderers were in different parts of the country. The female was, now in her 40s and living in Queens, New York. So when I was having lunch with my friend, Ted Kurgan, the murder victim's brother, was actually in Queens right behind the detectives who were getting ready to rearrest her. Ted Kurgan was everywhere in this investigation. So she's texting him, and I'm like, what's going on? I was fascinated. She said, well, Ted's in New York. He's following them, and they're arresting Lila, and he's at her apartment. And I'm like, what? And so I just, she couldn't tell me everything. So she said, I don't know if I can tell you. I can't tell you this, can't tell you that. And so I just drove her crazy. And I later became part of their little group that was putting together these timelines and everything. And so that's how I literally got thrown into it. I was trained as a reporter, and it was just super fascinating to me to help put together all of these things and find out that here was this 19-year-old girl, and what were her motives? How did she end up in New Orleans? How did she meet this guy? Did they, why did they decide to murder Gary? You know, her diaries, we had her diaries. The diaries were fascinating reading, talking about everything from her, she was fascinating about her weight, but they also had animals. They had gerbils and other things that they were possibly testing poison on. I mean, all this was revealed through her diary. So I was totally in at that time. So from December of 2012 moving forward, I was just, they kept, we had a map that had a strange map that had been found. It was part of the documents in the investigation that had, you know, a picture of a levee. You know, I'm in Louisiana, so almost the end of the Mississippi River, and so there was a picture of the levee and trees and a big X as if something was buried there. And so there were all these pieces of this puzzle, and, you know, it was irresistible to try to help put them together.
I'm going to rewind a little bit here, and let's focus a little bit, first of all, on how exactly Gary Kurgan ran into these two killers, and what exactly made authorities think to begin with that these two were the killers, that this prostitute and this grifter boyfriend were the killers. What were the signs that pointed to them?
Well, in 1984, Gary Kurgan, although he was from a town that was about 60 miles west of Baton Rouge, was spending a lot of time in Baton Rouge because they were about to open a whole new development agreement with Sonic, dozens of new restaurants. So he was actually had an office here in Baton Rouge and would, you know, sometimes spend, you know, nights there, evenings there. And he had just gotten approval on a bank loan to fund this expansion of their restaurants, and was expected in his hometown where his brother Ted was waiting so they could celebrate this big news. But Gary never showed up. And so Gary was last seen at this club. We'll call it a strip/dance club. And in last seen with this girl who was 19 years old at the time. And she was known to live half a mile from the club with this 36-year-old man. So that's how they became suspects. And then they had fled. They fled Baton Rouge, but were, it's a weird chain of events, but they were later uncovered in Las Vegas. So they were suspects because she was the last person seen with him.
Okay. So she was seen with him, and they were put at the scene of that club together, and that leaves that with that.
I left the club together, yes.
Okay. So at that point, there are no other suspects.
There never were any other suspects. Okay. There never were any other suspects at all.
Okay. Now, where does the boyfriend come in, or when does the boyfriend become a suspect? Because this is a weird combination, and you mentioned it once before. You mentioned the combination of clown and porn star or porn director. Give me a little bit.
Yeah, he was Ron Dunnigan, the murderer, Ron Dunnigan, was a costume clown. He made balloons in the New Orleans French Quarter for, you know, kids, and he worked at a porn shop, and he and Lila had lived in an apartment building there with another man who left, and she sort of ended up on Ron Duncan's doorstep, and they began this relationship. It was a very unusual, obviously, combination, but then they moved to Baton Rouge really quickly. And, you know, part of our investigation was to try to discover whether or not they had perhaps murdered some other people in New Orleans, because they left New Orleans very quickly to come to Baton Rouge after living in New Orleans for about a year and a half. Yeah. He was we didn't know at the time in 2012 with the rearrest if he was armed and dangerous, what kind of individual, if he was, a really dangerous kind of person, but as it turned out, he was not the mastermind. She was the mastermind. As unlikely as it was, a very unlikely thing. But she, at 19 years old, was the one manipulating and pulling the strings.
Really? Because it seems like his MO is very John Wayne Gacy like.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But yeah. as it turns out, he was totally smitten, as, you know, you would, you know, she was a beautiful 19-year-old girl and very bright. He was totally smitten and pretty much did what she asked him to do.
If you would, just...
She was, you know, I like to think she was the brains and he was the brawn.
Okay. If you would, go into those diaries for a minute, because you said some things out there that were kind of fascinating and a little macabre at that. You said something about experimenting with animals and was there...
Yes, and... I'm sorry?
Go ahead. Were they experimenting with toxins or poisons, or what were they doing?
The poisons were not mentioned specific in the diary, but she talks about acquiring animals and, you know, talks about how they, you know, weren't feeling well, or she never specifically mentions poison, but, you know, she mentions in her diary, you know, I hate to say it's a typical teenager diary because it's anything but typical, but the writing style was much as you'd see in a teenager like that. It was very, I need to lose weight and, you know, I need to stop smoking and, mm-hmm. you know, I need to stop being so bossy. I mean, she says over and over in her diary, I need not to be so bossy. So, you know, there was the school of thought that she was his sex slave, that she was his victim. But I don't think anybody who read any part of the diary couldn't see that she was a victim in any way. In fact, there were times when she left New Orleans and came back of her own volition. So, you know, obviously if she would have been in the dangerous position, she wouldn't have had to return to him. There was no reason to return. So, but anyway, back to the diary, she did talk about acquiring the animals and what they ate and how they didn't feel well, but she doesn't mention the poison specifically. She also talks about dancing. She danced in clubs in New Orleans, and she also danced in clubs in one club in Baton Rouge. So she talks about that, and she talks about that she was dancing in clubs and how much money she made from John. So she was very specific. She had one whole calendar where she just wrote how much money she made from her Johns every night. So, you know, she was a prostitute as well.
Okay. Was there any point in the diaries where she's getting specific about bringing home Johns and then being transparent about crimes she might have committed in those diaries?
She was very specific. Gary is mentioned several times in her diary, and she even goes so far as to say, I'm going to hit Gary next time. And she refers to him as Sonic Gary. Sonic Gary didn't show up, or I got $200 from Sonic Gary. So he does appear in her diary in that last month four or five times. She also talks about other Johns and that she's waiting on them. She doesn't specifically mention what she's going to do to them, but she talks about, definitely in the diary, it says, hit Gary next time. So that was pretty damning evidence, and obviously it proves that the murder was planned.
Okay.
Or something was planned.
I know this seems like a weird question to ask, but follow me on this. Did it seem like there was it cold and calculating, those diary entries, or was there any terms of affection towards her clientele, or was there any, and I don't want you to read too far into it, but was there any seeming emotion behind these entries, or was it like an entry into an accounting ledger?
No, there was emotion. I mean, she talked about some of her Johns, that she liked them and that, you know, they were cute and that they went out to have a steak dinner. She talks very affectionately about Ron, that she loves him, you know, that he gave her, you know, some kind of jewelry. So, I mean, so, like I said before, some of it does sound like a teenage diary. You know, so-and-so was cute. She talks about, you know, there's some current events sprinkled in there. you know, some lighthearted stuff. So no, it's not like a cold, like a murderer's calculated diary. It's but you know, in there, you know, and she talked about how cute the animals were, you know, and but yeah, but anyway, so and as we go on, I mean, she actually she talked about the poison. She talked about poison later on, and she, as the police, after the police arrested her. So she brought up the poison, which made the diary entries so much, obviously so much more poignant.
Okay.
That might have happened.
So then, in relation to that, talking about her Johns, how does she talk about her boyfriend in the diary? Because it...
She talks about how much she loves him, and that she would do, you know... how much he does for her, and how she has to stop being bossy to him, and she has one kind of chilling entry where she says how much she loves him, but yet she needs some sex on the side. She always will need to have her tricks on the side. So obviously, sort of a troubled person here.
Interesting. So
she does talk very affectionately about him.
But yet, she's not the one in the duo doing the killing. She's doing the ordering.
She's not the one what?
She's not the one doing the killing. She's the one doing the ordering. Am I misunderstanding?
I think she was, you know, we don't know. I mean, in the book, it talks about the night of the murder, but there's, she told many different stories about the night of the murder. She told many different accounts of how Gary died.
Okay, well, and let's get to that part then, and then I'll follow up with that and why I'm going down this road.
Sure.
So let's follow through with that night of the murder. What happened to Gary supposedly on that night of that murder? And line this up for me, if you would, Chris, with what potentially that journal entry would have said, because it sounds like, was it Lila? Was that her name?
Yes, her name is Lila Mulla.
Okay, so Lila would have put in her journal that she missed Sonic Gary, missed him once or twice, but then he manages to show up. What was her journal entry shortly before she met him? Was it optimistic? Was it?
No, it was hit Gary next time.
Okay.
And then the next day it says something like, I'm waiting for a trick, and it has something like blank nor blank showed up. So it may be interpreted that Gary was just the unlucky one who showed up at the wrong time, that someone else may have been murdered. They were not going to stay in Baton Rouge. So they were ready, you know, she talks over and over about wanting to become famous and move California, be an actress or a model. So Baton Rouge was not their final destination. So some thought that reading through her diary that she was looking for different tricks, that Gary was the one who showed up that night, or that she lured there that night, because Gary was supposed to be going home. And, the fact that that's what his brother was so concerned about, because Gary never, ever didn't come home without calling. I mean, he had a place in Baton Rouge. He could have called and said he was staying, but he didn't. And so they were very alarmed when he didn't come home that night. But she lured him to the club in some way, and they left together and went to Lila's duplex, which was just a short distance from the club. And Gary was murdered in that duplex. And as I mentioned, she told several different accounts of what happened that night. Confessed to the murder several times, but the stories all tried to take all of the responsibility away from her. She says that, you know, they were there in the duplex to have sex, and that she poisoned him with tainted wine, and he fell down, but he didn't die, and Ron finished, and, you know, that was one story. And then there were a lot of different stories. There were stories that she never saw what happened. She didn't really see. They were something about, you know, something went wrong with the sex, and she was upset, and Ron came out from a closet and took care of Gary while she was in another room. You know, there were different accounts, several different accounts of what actually happened. So, but there was a lot of signs in the duplex that there was a struggle, and there was a huge fight had taken place, and blood evidence there too.
How officially did the coroner say that Gary met his end?
You know, there would be no coroner's report because the body was not found.
Oh,
which
okay.
which is why they were initially let go in 1985.
Oh, so they got rid of the. I got it. Okay, so they because
and
he was missing.
And there's a number of ways they said they got rid of the body too. There were a lot of different stories, but the main one centers around the fact that Gary's remains were put in the trunk of his own car, and I don't know what happened to Gary. There were several different renditions of that, but there was enough blood evidence in the trunk that police knew when the car was found that there was enough blood that someone died there. So the blood evidence was, and then the DNA match was what got them rearrested in 2012.
So Lila admits she had sex with Gary. She admits that she poisoned his wine. She admits that there was some not so great things going on there. She admits that Ron might have jumped him. She admits that there was a struggle, but yet there was no solid arrest.
They were detained in Las Vegas, and then she told one of her first of many different confessions, and that's when they were arrested.
But not charged.
Yes, they were charged.
Okay.
She was charged first, but then she implicated him, and then he was charged. And he has a totally different personality from her. He didn't say anything. I mean, he said very few words. He said very few words throughout all of this, except that he did. My friend who first got me involved in the story, Ann Edelman, actually was able to befriend Ronald Dunnigan, the other murderer, and she did get some information out of him. But as far as on the record, he said almost nothing.
What did he say off the record? Just to be curious.
He liked Gary Kurgan. And his story was that, to Ann Edelman, not on the record, his story was that, yes, Gary Kurgan came back to their duplex. But you see, in Ron's magical way of thinking, he didn't really ever want to admit to Ann that Lila was a prostitute. So he says that Gary came to the duplex to have some drinks with them, and then he went off to New Orleans, which is, a 90-minute drive or so, and that's where his car was found. But he said, Ron Dunnigan says the last time he saw him, he was going to New Orleans to party. So that was his story off the record.
Which wouldn't implicate him in the slightest.
Right, exactly.
So I'm curious as to why he didn't tell that to the cops then.
Well, he did. When he was rearrested, what he said to them was, he said, I didn't murder this man. And he said, you don't have a body, do you? So that was what he said.
Uh-huh.
So we spent a lot of time analyzing that one statement, because at first we thought he was taunting the detectives by saying that, thinking, well, you're not going to get me because you don't have a body. But then after Ann spent some time with him and we all did some background work, he's really kind of a simpleton. And so maybe the inflection was not that, but it was more like nervous. You don't have a body, do you? Kind of thing.
Right.
So it was, yeah. So
yeah.
After learning more about him, he really was not any kind of a clever man. He's, even though he had street smarts, he was more of a simpleton who was guided by Lila.
Right, kind of the phrase like, well, you don't have a body. Well, why are you arresting me? You don't have a body, do you? Kind of like a, yeah, it's a challenge.
Not taunting him like, you know, I got rid of that body, so you'll never find it. Wasn't right. like that at all.
It's a challenging question. Like, well, if you don't have anything, why am I here? You know, which you're right. It, for someone of, and I'm not saying this to challenge any of our audience or anything like that, but if for someone of a lower intelligence, that sentence makes sense to someone of, I guess, average intelligence, that sounds like a guilty statement. That sounds like, to someone in a prosecutorial, if that's a word, position, that would sound like a guilty statement. Well, you don't have a body, do you? Well, that to me sounds like you're trying to cover something up. But to someone who is sitting there saying that sentence, that's a kind of a snide way of saying, well, you know, you don't have anything. What am I doing sitting here?
It's, exactly.
You know,
I didn't kill him. You don't have a body, do you? I didn't kill him.
Right. It's not having enough tools in the toolbox in order to convey what it is you're trying to say, which is, you know, I don't, obviously I'm not sitting here with blood on my hands. So what am I doing here? So at this point, Ron and Lila are sitting there there's a potential lack of evidence with the exception of blood in the trunk. What do police do at this point to try and nail the two of them down? Or what is it that they can or can't do, or prosecutors can or can't do to try and keep them there?
The prosecutors, you know, they needed a witness. They needed a witness, and it was more than likely going to need to be Lila because Ron Dunnigan was not really talking at all. So it was Lila who took a plea deal, a very long sentence plea deal, which is very suspect in itself, and agreed to testify against him at a trial, at Ron Dunnigan's trial. And there were a lot of times when that almost didn't work out. That almost didn't happen. It was a weird turn of events, but it ended up happening, and he was tried for the murder. But the real, you know, those are the facts of the case. But all during this time, you know, Ted Kirkham is very much a part of and a consulted. He's being consulted by the assistant district attorney who's prosecuting the case because Ron Dunnigan is actually let go for a while. He is let out of prison. I'm trying to think. The grand jury decides. Trying to remember the legal term, but not to take action at that time, that they could still take action at a later date, but not to take immediate action on him. And so he was let out of prison, and Ted had him followed everywhere. And actually, that's when my friend Ann Edelman befriended him, and that's when they actually brought in Tim Miller of Texas Equisearch, which Texas Equisearch is a nonprofit which Tim created. Tim's own daughter was murdered, and he created this nonprofit to help families of people who disappeared, murder victims, but also just people who disappeared, try to locate either the loved ones or their bodies. So Ted actually brought Tim Miller in, who befriended Ron Dunnigan, all in an attempt to get him to confess. And more than that, the two things Ted Kirkham really wanted to know was what happened to his brother that night in the duplex, and where his brother is. Where is his brother buried? Where are his remains? So while Ron was out, they actually went on a few trips looking, you know, that he was supposedly going to take him to find the body. And all that was fascinating, fascinating.
Why would
he is not the most, this guy has some mental issues, and so it was,
I was going to say, you're facing time, you're facing charges, and this guy from Texas, or did you say it was Texas EquiSearch? Is that what the name of it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's from the Houston area.
And Ted Kurgan come to you and say, we just want to know where the body is. And
right, and actually he has... When Tim Miller was actually brought in, they conducted a search based on this map that I alluded to earlier. So he came in, Tim Miller came in, and they did the dig, which, you know, happened. It was very interesting. And then they also, Tim Miller also befriended Ron Dunnigan in an attempt after the dig to tell him where he might be, where Gary Kurgan's remains might be.
So Ron actually gave up that information before being tried completely?
Not exactly.
Not exactly.
But
okay.
He did lead them on several paths, probably in the right, you know, in the right direction.
Okay,
he
so
you
he,
know, but then
so he
but then Ron
hints.
Had a very drastic end to all of this. He tried to hurt himself.
Okay.
So ended that whole thing. So they never got to the bottom of it with him.
Okay. I was going to say we should backtrack a little bit here and cover a little bit of ground here. So he did throw out hints to them as to where the body potentially would be. Where did he say?
Well, actually, I'm saying where the body would be. He and Lila went on trips to the levee.
Okay.
To shoot guns and do other things. So I'm not sure, you know, they had him take him on these trips to show them where he and Lila had been.
Okay.
And not specifically saying, show us where the body's buried, but take us where y'all went when you were together. You went here, you went there. And all of that brought up, you know, he did take them to a couple of places, but then, you know, then he just totally retreated and tried to hurt himself. So they didn't actually state it as where is Gary buried,
okay,
or whatever,
okay,
but just take us to where places you had been with Lila.
Okay, so they were looking for
guns. But meanwhile, I mean, Tim is pretty, you know, while he's telling him take us to places you've been, he's saying you need to tell Ted Kurgan what happened to his brother. He needs to have this peace. I deal with these families all the time. This is, you know, something you have to give him this piece. Well, it all, you know, the result was, you know, Ron trying to hurt himself, you know, not after that. So that was how that part of the story.
Where was Ron when he tried to hurt himself? Was he at home? Was he?
He was in. I was there outside. He was actually at a motel near the Mississippi River levee and near Baton Rouge, on the other side of the river from Baton Rouge. He's from North Louisiana, but Tim Miller went and got him in North Louisiana and brought him back to the motel in an attempt to try to get him to give up information.
And was this just a matter
of... At this time, he had been released from prison.
Was this just a matter of Tim Miller was getting too close, or was Ron starting to feel remorse? Was that the reason why he attempted
to
try to take his life?
I think
that
Tim Miller was getting too close.
Okay.
And I think Tim Miller was getting too close. I think that was definitely it. I think Ron is a paranoid schizophrenic.
Okay.
So, you know, he has other issues too. So I think just it was the whole day of that and going out to the levee and all that made him try to hurt himself. So that was how that part ended, but it was a super dramatic part of the story for all of us because Ted Kurgan was actually following them to the places on the levee. He was, you know, wherever this investigation went, Ted Kurgan was there.
Okay, so
the whole time.
So Ron,
amazing.
Ron and Ted really didn't meet each other.
No,
while this was going on.
There's a couple of very dramatic moments. Actually, when they were on this part of the journey on the levee, they passed each other in a convenience store type setting.
Okay.
And but they never met. And there's another incident when Ted and Ann went to North Louisiana to visit to visit Ron Dunnigan, and Ted went with them and acted as the chauffeur. So he was actually in the car with Ron Dunnigan.
And kept his cool.
Yeah, it was amazing. There's so many. That's just a couple of amazing parts of the story, but just the stuff that Ted Kergan did to bring out the whole story, to try to get to the bottom of the whole story, to find out what happened to his brother, to find out where his brother was, just a Herculean effort.
Wow. Wow. So this search in total, from the time that Gary goes missing to the time where Ted finally gets some sort of resolution, lasted how long?
The trial was, Ron Dunnigan's trial was in September of 2015. So by that time, it had been almost 31 years.
My gosh. So catch me up then. So Lila went from, what happened with Lila and Ron then? So when Ron...
You know, that was another thing we didn't know, if they were in communication. The police, the detectives didn't know that. So when they were rearrested, there were, all these precautions made, so that they were done simultaneously in case, one was talking to the other one and would reveal it or something. So, but in fact, I don't think they ever spoke again in the ensuing years.
So Lila essentially...
talked a little bit about it in the book, but I don't think they... They were not in communication with each other. They lived their own lives.
So Lila essentially flipped on Ron and walked away?
Oh, no. She took a plea deal, a very long, lengthy prison sentence plea deal, and flipped on it.
So
Gary's death, Ted, in consultation with the assistant district attorney, insisted on a very long prison sentence as part of Lila's plea deal. And no one thought she would take it, but she did.
How long did she end up serving?
She's in prison for 30 years.
Oh, so she's still there.
Yeah, they were, she went to prison in 2014. And he was, her, I guess she had time, credit for time served. And then his sentence was handed down in September of 2015. Life without parole.
I'm going backwards and talking about from the time that Gary was killed to the time where things were revealed with Gary's body. Was there any communication between Lila and Ron? Were they at what point did they? I mean, at some point they're a couple, and at some point they decide that they're done with each other. I mean, obviously, when you flip on somebody, you would think they're done.
There was some planning on Ron's part to try to meet up or whatever. This was after they were released. They were released at separate times in 1985.
Okay.
And I think he had instructed her to, some meeting, but it didn't happen. Her parents came from a very wealthy family in Kent, Ohio, and her parents came and picked her up. And I don't believe, according to Ron, even off the record to my friend, that they never spoke again.
So she came from a wealthy family, yet she got herself in that much trouble. I mean, it doesn't seem...
She's a very interesting character. Yeah, she was an honor student, as I said. She played violin in the symphony. She was a track star. And then somewhere in her senior year of high school, she got involved with drugs or a bad crowd or... Anyway, so... But she left drug rehab and made her way to Louisiana.
And then just decided that, hey, prostitution's a good way to go.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, she didn't have much of a plan at that time. But anyway.
And the porn star clown boyfriend's a great move.
She showed some She showed some signs in her growing up that there was trouble, though, that she was, you know, she had some issues as even as a younger child. But
I'm curious what Ron's background is now.
Ron's background?
Yeah.
He was raised by an abusive stepfather. His mother, he spent formative years in California, was brought back to North Louisiana after his mother divorced the stepfather. He was around 20 or 21. He married a 14-year-old. They had two daughters. The marriage didn't last long. And he worked kind of odd jobs, like a couple of plant kind of jobs. He worked in Las Vegas as a clown for a while, and that's why they went back to Las Vegas after the murder. He was familiar with Las Vegas, and then he also worked in New Orleans, as we talked about before. And he loved the whole clown and magic thing, so he's just a really odd character, too. And he was not super attractive as a 36-year-old, but as a now, as he's in his 60s, he looks like a very scary Santa Claus. Big, wild white hair, wild white beard.
Really?
Large man. So he's a very, very strange-looking character. And he, at the time of the arrest, he was living on disability. Some kind of limited disability. And he lived off and on in, pay by the week hotel, motel kind of things. And he lived at homeless shelters. So, he was, kind of a person who didn't need a whole lot to get by. And plus, he had the mental illness.
Right, right.
As well.
So, Ted Kergan continues on throughout the years, and he's pushing. And he's pushing to find his brother.
You know, he is pushing. He keeps up with them. You know, he knows where they are all the time. You know, he has private investigators. He's on the internet. So yes, he keeps up with them. But the case, as I talked about earlier, the case got resurrected because of a grant given to the Baton Rouge Police Department for cold cases. But the fact that Gary's case got pulled out of a stack of cold cases, and it was what happened was very strange. One of the people in the police department, she wasn't a detective, but her name is Memory Tucker. Her father, Larry Tucker, was Gary and Ted's business partner in the Sonic venture. And Larry was very much involved in the investigation, early stages of the investigation. So his name is in the police report, et cetera. So when the police are reviewing this file, they ask Memory Tucker, "Do you know this guy, Larry Tucker? He's in this file on Sonic Gary." And she's like, "Larry Tucker is my father." So such an odd coincidence. The case gets reopened, and Memory is actually the one who calls Ted Kergan. I mean, she's known Ted Kergan all her life.
Hmm.
And she's the one who calls him and tells him the case is being reopened. I mean, it came out of nowhere. Even though he's kept up with the murder victims, he was not expecting the case to get reopened.
And just like that.
So as you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, you never want to give up.
No, you never, never do. No. No. You wanna stay tenacious and keep on that. And just like that, it's reopened, and that evidence was still around, and that blood evidence was still good?
Yes, is that amazing? Yes, the blood evidence was still around. It was amazing. And also a lot of people who were involved with the case originally were still involved in law enforcement at Baton Rouge, which was also odd. The district attorney, Hiller Moore, was the crime scene investigator in 1984, and his office ended up prosecuting the case in 2015. So there were, a lot of people connected. The two detectives who originally investigated the case in 1984, one of them testified at the 2015 trial.
Wow.
So, there were people still, and it was one of those cases, and I know you hear this over and over again, but it was one of these cases that people never forgot. Not only Ted Kergan, but people in law enforcement remembered it. Because in 1984, it was before as I learned, it was before the advent of crack cocaine. So it was very unusual, especially in Baton Rouge, sleepy Baton Rouge at that time, for a businessman to be murdered. You know, it's mostly, if there were murders, there were very few in a year, and those would be as a result of a domestic dispute or something like that.
Right.
So this was a weird occurrence, an unusual occurrence, and for, you know, it, and then the people who committed it. So anyway, yeah, so the, how it got reopened was extremely weird. But, you know, as I said, Ted was, he knew where they were. He kept up with them all this time. And his main mantra at that time when he found out the case was being reopened is, they're not going to get away with it again. They're not, I'm going to do whatever I have to do because they're not going to get away with it again. But many times during the whole thing, they almost did. They almost did.
How did they almost get away with it again? What could have potentially tripped it up?
Well, as I mentioned, a lot of things could have happened. Lila confessed several times, which I'm not really sure why she did. Ron Dunnigan was in very poor health and had attempted suicide several times, and he could have easily not made it to the trial. Other things that happened, I mean, she had to agree to testify against them, which she on and off said she would do, said she wouldn't do. And her testimony, which is very compelling, the whole trial was pretty compelling. Her testimony, while it got him convicted, was not, there was not a whole lot of truth in it. So it, you know, there were many times when, you know, everyone was on pins and needles because a lot of things could have happened differently or could have gone down differently. She could have not taken the plea deal. That's 30 years. Why would you take why wouldn't you just take your chances and let them try you?
Yeah, although, you know, there might have been the guilty conscience at play, too, at that point. You know, she could have just decided, I've lived with this long enough. And, you know, there could be something to be said about, you know, a changed person. Who knows? I mean, we're not in her head.
But it was remarkable that it ended up coming to fruition that there was a resolution. It wasn't the whole resolution, but there was most of a resolution. And, but it was a real roller coaster ride because, you know, there were times, you know, like I said, when she refused, she said she wouldn't testify, when Ron, you know, would attempt to commit suicide, you know, just all these, and there was, you know, a case where a key piece of evidence had to be found in Las Vegas, and it was almost impossible to, in fact, the assistant district attorney couldn't find it, and Ted Kirkin went to action and found resources to find it. So there were a lot of little things along the way where things could have fallen through, and they could have been. But, you know, it was just, like I said, I mean, I just really think of Ted Kirkin as a hero because he did everything, not only, and I've had the comment since the book came out, well, you know, if you had those resources, anybody would do that. And I disagree with that because I was sort of embedded in the whole thing. And I saw the things that Ted Kirkin did. And I mean, although he did have resources. One of the detectives said of Ted Kirkin, he processed things. He operated with almost military-like precision. He would process things and make a plan and then execute it. And time and time and time again, it was, it was remarkable. It really was. So I don't agree with that. I mean, I think just because you have the resources doesn't mean you have the ability or the will or the direction and the stamina to do the things that he did.
Were there, even though there were resources at Ted's disposal, was there still bureaucratic red tape that was in the way for Ted? I mean, I can't imagine it was
There was lots of that. There was lots of that.
I just can't imagine it was a cakewalk for him, you know?
Oh, no. There were plenty of times, as I mentioned, that piece of evidence. There was, times when they had to decide whether Ron would, was going to be charged or let go. I mean, over and over. And there were lots of times when he was totally at wit's end during the whole time. So yeah. And a lot of people would have given up and said, "I'm done with this," or I can't take this. And another thing that makes it totally remarkable to me, we spoke earlier about the process of writing a book and how much time it takes away from your loved ones and things that you know, part your everyday life before that. And he has this great way of sheltering his wife and son from all this that was going on. He didn't speak about it at home. Home was sort of his safe haven. Mm-hmm. So that was amazing to me. He couldn't have been married to me because I would have had too many questions. But he was able to, you know, preserve calm and whatever in his family life while all this chaos was going on in this investigation.
What was it? I mean, other than this is his brother, this is his blood, this was his, you know, this is probably his best friend. Other than that resolve, what was it that you felt kept pushing Ted? That kept him going to get this answer? Because as you've pointed out, he kept going where other people would have quit or failed or just, you know, given up.
I think you hit it. I mean, they were so close. They were extremely close. They had their own language almost. They were brothers. They were partners. They grew up together. Their father died when Ted was 1 day old. Gary was not only his brother and best friend, but almost, you know, a father figure. He was 4 years older than Ted. So it was just, and reading, you know, newspaper accounts. I mean, after this happened, Ted, it was hard for Ted to go on, you know. I mean, he had to pick up the pieces. He suddenly got thrust in the role of being the, Gary was formerly the patriarch of the family, and Ted got thrust in that role. And I think it was just, it was all about his relationship with Gary. And he said, when asked that kind of a question, he said, "Well, I know Gary would have done this for me." And that's what it was all about, is his relationship with Gary and what he thought he owed to Gary to get answers.
In your dealings with this story, do you feel like Ted finally was able to put his heart, his mind, his soul at ease after this was done? Or is there something, because Ted seems to me like the kind of guy who, now that this mission is over, there's a new mission. He doesn't seem like the kind of guy who rests very easily.
Well, this mission is not 100% complete. It still goes on, part of it, but he is, today he is a much more relaxed and at peace, yes, his whole demeanor, everything. No, I think, you know, certainly he has other life missions, personally, professionally, but I think this was, you know, a major life mission and one where he's just, you know, a huge, whatever, sigh of relief. He's very successful professionally. He's definitely a great family man, but I think this was just something he thought he owed to Gary, and he continues to work on it. It's not totally done yet. So, but after Lila and Ron after knowing they are in prison, it took a huge weight off of him. And yes, so I'm sure he lives his life much happier and more at peace.
What's the total end game of in your book, not necessarily in Ted's book, but what's the total end game when you lose someone who's that close to you, such as Ted lost with Gary? What to you would be the total end game, other than putting these people in jail and finding your dead brother's remains? What to you would be the end game of, okay, finally I'm done? What to you would wrap it up?
I don't know. You know, I don't think I could have done the things that Ted Kirk did. And I think I would have, at some point, you know, a couple of years later, Gary was declared legally dead. And I think at that time, you know, if it would have been my brother or whatever, I would have probably had a funeral and whatever. Ted never had a funeral for Gary. There was never a memorial service. There was never anything. So I think, that finding Gary would mean that there would be a service, that there would be some finality,
mm-hmm.
that he's not, you know, he wouldn't even go there. He's not going there. He's never held any kind of service for Gary.
Hmm.
So, you know, for myself, I probably would have, you know, given it to God or whatever and said, okay, I'll bury my brother. But, you know, Ted goes on. So, you know, he's a very unique person. I think he's a very strong person. And, you know, the bond between the brothers was just extraordinary.
I wonder how you file that away. You know.
Well, I think he files it away by making sure that Ron and Lila stay in prison. And that's a huge relief to him that they're paying for it. Finally.
Interesting indeed. So now with this book out and released, and the name of the book, by the way, My Brother's Keeper, A 30-Year Quest to Bring Two Killers to Justice, it's available right now on Amazon. Chris Russo Blackwood is the author we're talking to right now. Chris, where do you go from here now after this book is out?
Well, I haven't started another book. I live in South Louisiana, and there are several great stories that are out there, and a couple of great cold cases that I've been looking at. So I don't know. I hope to write another book, but we'll see.
Has the true crime bug bitten you now? Is it something where you want to continue on and keep writing true crime, or is it one of those things where, you know, we've talked to other authors who have said, I need a change of pace. I think now I'm gonna focus on a different story and then maybe come back, because it is something that's thrilling. It is something that you can throw your whole self into, but you do need to back up because it is such a dark, macabre subject.
Well, you know, I've been told that while My Brother's Keeper is definitely a true crime, that it's also a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think I maybe am more drawn to that kind of a hybrid because there were a couple other cold cases in South Louisiana, and it's the story of the people surrounding the case, not so much the murder itself,
mm-hmm.
but the story surrounding it that really intrigues me.
Hmm.
So I think I would probably do that, but more looking to write about the history and the people more than focusing totally on the crime.
So as you wrapped up this, much like when you put a newspaper to bed, as you put My Brother's Keeper to bed, if you had to leave one thing with Ted Kergan, as you put this book to bed and you move on in your journey, he moves on in his, if you could leave one thing with Ted, whether it's to make everything all right or if it's just a parting gift to Ted as you move on, what would you leave with him?
Oh, I would like to help him plan Gary's funeral.
Yeah. And what would you plan as part of Gary's funeral, or what part of yourself would you leave in Gary's funeral to help Ted remember him?
Whoa, that's a hard one. What would I leave at Gary's funeral?
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, that's so hard. You know, Gary and Ted's mother died, you know, some time ago, but you know, this was always something. I guess some symbol of peace. Maybe it would be something with a dove or something that Ted and his family could be at peace.
Okay. It's always interesting because, you know, it I guess to me, when you spend this much time with a story and this much time around people and this much time cultivating their story, you feel like you get to know them intimately. So I you know, when you say help plan a funeral, you know, but I just, to me, it's interesting to know what exactly you would contribute to that. So, the book is out right now. My Brother's Keeper, A 30-Year Quest to Bring Two Killers to Justice. Chris Russo Blackwood is the author of that book, and you can get it right now on Amazon. And by all means, we'll have a link in the description of this show as well that you can follow and get the book as well. Chris, I want to thank you very much for being with us today on True Crime Tuesday.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you being with us as well. And like we mentioned, everybody, we will be back next week with Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, and we'll lighten it up next week for you. We want to wish Ripley Schrader all the best, and she'll be home hopefully a little bit later today and be recuperating at home instead of in that icky hospital bed. I know plenty about that icky hospital bed and diabetes and all that other stuff. So, Ripley, get well very soon, honey, and we love you, and we're praying for you and hope that you get better very, very soon. And Dave will be back next week with True Crime Tuesday. For Dave Schrader, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you for listening to the best in true crime talk radio. We'll be back with you next week right here on True Crime Tuesday.